From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Next week, Gonzaga will hold a series of events leading to the inauguration of Katia Passerini as the university's 27th president. Truth be told, she's already been on the job for a couple of months. We talk with her about free speech on campus and its challenges, and Gonzaga's embrace of climate change as a focus of research and study. Idaho Education News reporter Emma Epperly has written a new series about what it's like to be a K-12 school superintendent in Idaho and why fewer people are seeking the job. And on the eve of the next Apple Cup football game, longtime Seattle sports writer Bud Withers looks at the long history of the series. As the Cougar and Husky programs go in different directions, should the series be continued? Stay with us for this week's Inland Journal. Next week, Friday, Katia Passerini will be installed as Gonzaga University's next president. That ceremony will highlight a week-long series of events that celebrate the Jesuit University's history in Spokane. Passerini has been on the job for 2 months. She began during the quiet of summer and is glad to have the students back on campus.
It feels like a university has to feel like, with all the students going back and forth from class to class, especially in College Hall where we have our offices. It's great to hear students running from one room to the next. I love it.
Passerini says she tries to get out of her office as often as she can so she can be around the people who live and work on campus. One of her first challenges is how to lead Gonzaga through the debates that have been sparked by the Charlie Kirk killing and the war in Gaza, among other things.
It seems that we have arrived at a place where we're not able to talk about issues anymore. They are immediately politicized and polarized in one way or the next, and it's really important for us to be able to engage in conversations again. And violence is never the solution. I was blessed just about a year ago to meet a Nobel Peace Prize for Liberia. She ended basically single-handedly with other women the civil war in Liberia. And she was always asked what side of are you on? And her answer was beautiful, and I will always remember it. I am on the side of humanity, and violence is never the solution. So I think as the conversation changed, not yet, but it needs to change. It needs to be civil dialogue and opportunity to talk together and understand that sometimes we can disagree on issues, but we have to have this ability to talk to each other without going too extreme on any side.
But that's easy to say.
It's easy,
I mean,
yes.
Spencer Cox in Utah is trying his best to lower the temperature, but you've got the folks who are Charlie Kirk acolytes on one side, then you've got people who are complaining about anti-Semitism, you've got people who are Palestinian, you've got people from all sides. What's your approach to try to deal with all of that and make this civil?
Yeah, so we need to always remember that we need to be always well-informed. Some of the issues we're dealing here with today have historical roots, and we need to understand where they are and why are we so separated. Years of misunderstandings that we need to be aware of. So what can we do practically, though? As an educational institution, we need to continue to educate the students on all sides of the issues. We are going to be working on a center of institute to be defined for civil dialogue and humanistic thought. And if you think about it, merging those two is very important because it's through thinking about humanity, historical perspective, literature, political perspective, and engaging in the dialogue like Ignatius has taught us, that we can arrive to an understanding. So is that enough? No, but it's a first step of bringing people together in the same room to start thinking both intellectually and practically about issues.
Do you have students come to you and say, I don't feel safe on this campus?
Not just students, everyone might be at times not feeling safe, and it is our responsibility that if they do not, we take action to make sure that they do feel safe. So it hasn't happened yet, but I I'm not naive. It's going to happen. It's bound to happen for many different reasons. So some might not be feeling safe because of the political debate. Some might not be feeling safe because they have left home and they feel alone. And so one thing that I'm really proud of, and I've been looking at it, the way we do it, and I think we're very well positioned. We have a lot of student support services and interventions and opportunities for students to come together and get help where they need. And the same can be said also for our staff and employees. We have a lot of work that the human resources is doing around the same line to be prepared for anything that can come at us.
Has the university upgraded its security, thinking that, you know, we live in a pretty violent world right now, in order to be able to make sure that people, when they feel like they're walking around, they feel okay?
I think the security has always been a strong security team. I'm delighted to actually see them. They've done recently a campaign on them on the bicycle going all over the campus, and there are some funny videos that you can look at. It's a very strong team. I shared exactly in this room, actually, a couple of weeks ago, I met with the HR team and our securities within human resources. And I shared the story of when I was interviewing for the position, I was incognito, just walking back from here to downtown Spokane. I was through the Centennial Trail, and there was a little agitation on the road, and I realized that there was campus security just behind me, and they didn't know who I was. I was just somebody walking down the Centennial Trail, but they were there monitoring that I, a passerby, was safe. So I have to say I'm really impressed with what they do, and hopefully we will continue to see that level of excellence as anything that comes at us.
So the university has also taken a strong stance in terms of climate. Is the university kind of put itself out on a limb here? Do you feel in this current climate that that's not a good place to be?
I think that's, again, as I mentioned before, dialogue and understanding. We need to look at the science and see what it is that we can be doing to alleviate a problem that we see in our scientific research. And there are multiple ways of doing this. You can also say it's not a problem and let it happen, or you can continue to study and see what can we actually affect. And I think we have an institute for our climate change that is doing terrific work. We have to continue to be there and see what else should we be doing. For example, energy consumption is a big unknown, especially considering the energy pressure that we have from the use of technology like artificial intelligence. And so there are a couple of ways of looking at this. You can say, well, no, we should stop AI, which is very difficult to do and impossible, or we should continue, for example, with our School of Engineering, to identify a way and do new research that can help us affect energy consumption. And, for example, one of our partners' companies that we work with and our students, and support some of our students' undergraduate research, is working on cooling system for big data centers. As we get there, more energy efficiencies, new discoveries, new behaviors, I think it's important for us to continue to be involved in that, to try to find a possible solution. We will not have the only solution, but it's our duty to continue to work towards that.
With the current administration, are you putting funding, say research funding, teaching funding, at risk because of being out there in terms of climate and the university's position?
I don't know that we're more at risk for climate or anything else. The reality is that there are serious budget constraints, especially connected to research. So what we're trying to do is, first of all, see which research that was funded before is not funded anymore and identify alternative ways. If it's not through the federal system, maybe there is corporate or philanthropic support that we can find to be able to continue this research. So we have been affected some. We've been even more affected from other cuts, and those are not just at the federal level, but also at the state level for funding for students. For example, the state NEET grants has been halved, and now as a university, we're looking at how can we make sure that the students who are already here that have half of the money that they were receiving before can continue and graduate and then find a job and become, you know, self-actualized here at Gonzaga University. So we're looking at every possible way to continue to support them.
Have you had immigration agents come on campus?
No, we haven't had, not to my knowledge. I know that last year some of the visas, as it happened throughout the country, were at risk and revoked. I know that we had worked very closely with CVs and the local officials to make sure that the students were had an opportunity to be reinstated if that was possible, and from what I know, we were able to do so. We are more aware that when our international students travel or international faculty travel abroad, we always prepare. There is a Center for Global Engagement downstairs that prepares them with the possibilities of delays or risks. And so, so far, we have been consistently able to bring everyone back, but it's something that we continue to monitor.
Katia Passerini is the new president of Gonzaga University. Her formal installation ceremony is next Thursday at the McCarthy Athletic Center. And now on to education leaders at the K-12 level. The job of a school superintendent varies from district to district. In a city like Spokane, the superintendent is an overseer of a big enterprise. In a small town, that superintendent is more likely to be a jack of all trades. Recently, Emma Epperly from Idaho Education News focused on the job of superintendent with a four-part series. What did you learn from asking superintendents about what they do?
We kind of broke it down in our main story in this series to a few different issues. There's pay and there's politics and there's just kind of this increased workload. So executive leadership team of eight, and then there's like 12, I think, people who support that leadership team, and they have like different departments. But in smaller school districts, so I did a profile of Tana Kellogg, who is the superintendent in Highland.
That's the district that's headquartered in Craigmont on Idaho's Camas Prairie.
You know, she spends the majority of her time in this office that is like the size of a walk-in closet doing paperwork. And she has to do so much paperwork because small school districts have the same amount of reporting requirements as West Ada. And so they have to do, you know, federal reports, state reports. She's also part-time special education director. She's the federal programs director. She's the athletic director. So she really spends the majority of her time doing this paperwork. But also, she doesn't have a big support staff team, right, that would normally take on that paperwork. So she's doing the paperwork for a handful of jobs. But then she also has to manage typical superintendent things like going to the Board of Trustee meetings and, you know, making presentations to them. She has to do some disciplinary stuff because she only has one principal for K-12. So she has a lot of tasks that fall on her plate really directly, individual student interaction, compared to the superintendent of a bigger district.
Another thing you write about is that there's a lot of turnover among superintendent's jobs in Idaho, and all you have to do is read Idaho Ed News periodically to see this superintendent went from this small town to this small town. Once in a while, you get folks coming in from the outside. How do school districts handle that when there's so much transition at the top?
Yeah, so in this series, we reported 71% of Idaho school districts have had at least one turnover event in the last 5 years. But I think the really maybe more shocking numbers were multiple turnover events. So there was a shocking proportion of districts that had like 3+ turnover events. And often that's small rural schools. So a good example would be the Mountain View School District. That's at the bottom of my coverage area in Grangeville. They're going through a deconsolidation process right now. So they're splitting into two school districts. But they have had basically a new superintendent every year for the last 5 years. And they just really struggle to hire people. A lot of the times the people who apply for these jobs don't have their superintendent credential. So they would be having to get that credential. Ultimately, in Mountain View, they were able to get a retired superintendent to come on and take on the job to see them through this deconsolidation process. And that's really common to have retired superintendents either in the state of Idaho or from other states come in and just work for 3 years on a provisional certificate and then go back into retirement. So really in these small districts, it's hard to find people, and their pay, they're making sometimes often less than a principal at a larger district with way more responsibility and way more stress, and they're kind of on the call around the clock. So I know that that's a big issue for rural schools.
So Debbie Critchfield, whom you referenced before, the state school superintendent, has a proposal for figuring out how can we improve the pool for superintendent candidates? What's she talking about?
Yeah, so that's another thing that's going to be a big deal this legislative session, education-wise. She wants to reduce the requirements to become a superintendent. So basically, you would need a bachelor's degree and then 5 years of experience in education, government, nonprofit, private business, military, so basically anything. And then there'd be some mentorship requirements, and that mentorship would kind of help with some of these niche things like school finance, which is really complex and frankly confusing. Currently, superintendents, to get a certification, they need a master's degree. They need experience in the classroom. It's quite traditional pathways. So they have a master's degree and then they go to a superintendent certification program, which is additional college credits, which can be expensive. There's huge pushback to Critchfield's proposal. She did like a legislative roadshow after last legislative session, and she talked about this proposal. And there was a work group and some stakeholder input. And even stakeholders on that group weren't total fans of the final proposal. The Idaho Administrator Association, they did a survey of their members, and the majority really wanted like a master's degree requirement, at least, or wanted, you know, some alternative programs, but that still really focused on like the quality of the candidates. Superintendents across the state, when this program was pitched to them by Critchfield, pretty much universally from our reporting, weren't supportive. I quote in this piece, Matt McDaniel, he wrote a opinion column for us, and he runs a principal prep program at an Idaho college. And he said, it might be a quick fix to broaden the pool, but not deepen the pool of candidates. And that's kind of a quote that stuck out in my mind from the piece, that it might get more candidates, but are those candidates going to be good quality? Critchfield's kind of argued, well, what are we hiring for? You know, they're not teachers. They're not in the classroom. But superintendents say, well, you know, this is kind of part of devaluing our jobs. And that was a big topic is, you know, superintendents in general aren't feeling like their job is as prestigious as it used to be. You know, they're saying public education is under attack. And this is just another way that our job is being like deprofessionalized or devalued.
Are the same superintendents requirements for a public school the same for a private school or a charter school, or are those separate and distinct?
Those are separate and distinct. Okay. There is a lot more flexibility to be a charter school administrator than there is a public school superintendent. That is partially kind of what this was based on. This proposal is aligning closer to those kind of reduced or more flexible requirements for a charter school.
So were there lessons for you as you did reporting that you found surprising, unique, interesting?
I think the most surprising thing to me was just this idea of these two different jobs, like being the superintendent at a mid-size or large school district versus a small school district. I mean, it's true, like a superintendent at a small school district makes a lot less money than a principal or definitely like an assistant superintendent or a program director at a bigger district. And so if you take away money, it is really this like lifestyle factor and really like a community focused school at a smaller district. I think that keep people in those jobs and keep really people passionate about working in these smaller communities. The paperwork load was really shocking. And then I think lastly, one thing that is kind of buried in the story, but I find very interesting, is that there are just short of 500 people who have currently a superintendent qualification active in Idaho that could be a superintendent. There are 121 full or part-time superintendent jobs and 22 assistant superintendent positions. You know, there are enough people who have the qualifications in Idaho to have, if every job was open, to have like 3 applicants for each job. There are enough people who meet the current qualifications to do these jobs, and they just either don't want to or are staying in like a principal job with the superintendent certification.
Emma Epperly covers North Idaho for the online publication Idaho Education News. She recently wrote a 4-part series about superintendents. You can read it at idahoednews.org. On Saturday, the Washington Huskies and the Washington State Cougars will play the 117th Apple Cup football game on Giza Field in Pullman. It's a series that goes back to 1900. But it's an open question as to how long the rivalry will continue. Washington has moved on to the Big Ten Conference, and so it no longer is obligated to play Washington State. Seattle sports writer Bud Withers has just released a book about the Apple Cup called Too Good to Be Through. I asked if the title is an editorial comment about what he thinks about the future of the series, and he said yes.
It's just such a part of the way of sporting life in the state, and I just think it makes too much sense for the thing not to continue. I mean, it's for WSU, economically, not only at the school, but in the region over there, they need a big game. They need the hotels filled and the restaurants reservation list filled up. And for Washington, it's at a time when a lot of their trips are 2,000 miles to 2,500 miles. This is a 40-minute plane ride against an opponent that at least most years will be mid-level or better. So it would be a shame if it does somehow end.
It's a series that's been dominated by Washington, and there have been a lot of snoozers. But there have been exciting games with a lot on the line for one or both teams. Withers points to a 5-year period in the early 1980s as an example.
It was phenomenal. In 81, well, you're nodding, and that was your period of time in school.
Right.
Yeah. 81 was the year they met over here basically to decide who goes to the Rose Bowl. The Huskies ended up winning and needed help. I believe it was from USC against UCLA to get there. The next 2 years, as the Cougars, as people well remember, as double-digit underdogs both years in 82 and 83, kept the Huskies out of the Rose Bowl with victories.
The year that Chuck Nelson missed his field goal, year that he hadn't missed all year, and he misses one.
Exactly. Still holds the NCAA record for consecutive field goals with 30. In 84, the Huskies were bound to a New Year's Day bowl game, which was it turned out to be the Orange Bowl. And the Cougars had a 10-point lead on them in Pullman late in the third quarter and ended up, the Huskies put a pretty good rush on at the end and beat them. So that was a big-time game. And then to complete that 5-year stretch at Husky Stadium in really frigid conditions, in 85, the Cougars won 21-20 when they denied the Huskies a 2-point conversion in the last, can't remember, but it was very late in the game. Mm-hmm. It was inside the last 2 minutes, I think. So you'd be hard-pressed to find any rivalry in the country in that 5-year period that was as sizzling as the Apple Cup was.
So how would you characterize it now that Washington has moved on to the Big Ten and the Cougars are still where the Cougars are? How would you characterize the direction that the series is going?
It's clear as mud at this point. I mean, they're in the second year of a 5-year contract, which runs through 28, but it is in doubt after that. And it's been such a convulsive time in college athletics. Our heads are still spinning, I think, and certainly they're still spinning in both athletic departments. With all the NIL stuff and all the house settlement stuff and its implications for revenue sharing with athletes within the athletic departments. And to put a finer point on it, I mean, we don't really know if the Huskies are going to be like a perennial contender for a playoff spot as a result of being in the Big Ten, or are they going to be, like a typically a sixth or seventh place team in the Big Ten. And we don't know if the Cougars are going to be a frequent kingpin in the rejiggered Pac-12, or are they going to fall back to the middle of the pack and Boise State's going to dominate this league. I mean, there's just so many things we don't know. And I think the relative competitiveness of the two will have something to say about it. I mean, I really want to see the rivalry continue. And I think there's a lot of sentiment to make that happen. But, if it got to a point where for an extended period of time, Washington was winning by 6 touchdowns, then maybe they'd have to revisit the whole thing. But I just think it's the thing is so ingrained in the state and so much a part of the state's history and something that brings East and West together. And it just makes too much sense for these two schools not to play each other.
So in your research, we were talking about the games in the early 80s when both teams were really good. Are there kind of hidden Apple Cups that you found really interesting that you didn't know much about that really intrigued you?
I knew at least vaguely some of the earlier ones. There were ones, I mean, going way, way back. I think it was in 1936. The Cougars and Huskies were fighting, I believe, for the Pacific Coast Conference title at that time. And they met, I think that was the first year they met with a conference title on the line, right? And the Rose Bowl. And the Huskies just stomped the Cougars. I think it was 40-0. And, you know, it's intriguing to wonder how in the world that could have happened. And the only thing I remember is that one of the players was quoted in Dick Fry's book, the great WSU historian who wrote a book on WSU athletics. One of the players was quoted as saying that they had gotten really beat up in the previous game against, I believe it was UCLA, and they had lost a couple of really key players. And I think he also said Babe Hollingberry, who was of course the most decorated WSU coach of all time, this player said that Babe wanted that game so badly that he kind of overworked them in preparation for it. But they talk about a non sequitur. You know, you're playing for conference honors and you get beat 40-0. I mean, just hard to wrap your arms around that.
Longtime Cougar fans remember the heartbreak of the 1975 Apple Cup at Husky Stadium. The Cougars had a 27-14 lead and were driving deep in Husky territory in the last 2 minutes when Washington defensive back Al Burleson intercepted a pass and returned it the length of the field for a touchdown. Soon after, Washington got the ball back, and quarterback Warren Moon heaved a Hail Mary pass that was tipped by Cougar defenders into the hands of Husky receiver Spider Gaines, who ran it in for the game-winning touchdown.
It occurred to me the other day, this is the 50th anniversary of that crazy play. So, you know, these things are always never too far from the surface.
Usually the game is the Saturday after the Saturday before Thanksgiving, and so we've seen the pictures of snow flying and Drew Bledsoe throwing a touchdown pass to Philip Bobo or something like that, and this Saturday's game is going to be in 85 degrees. It's just a totally different feel. It's the fourth week of the season. Teams really are just feeling themselves out right now. Totally different feel. What do you expect?
You know, selfishly, I'd just like to see a good game. You'd like to see a competitive game, much like we had a year ago over here in Seattle, Lumen Field. You know, I would fear that there has been such a gap created over a year's time by the NIL forces and whatnot that the Washington is about to really put it to WSU. I mean, Husky fans would disagree with me at the drop of a hat, but I just don't think that's going to be real good for the rivalry. but it's remarkable how much things have pulled in opposite directions.
Bud Withers is a former sports writer for the Seattle Times and author of a new book, Too Good to Be Through, about the Washington-Washington State Apple Cup football rivalry. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SBR News. You can hear it every Thursday at 12:30 and every Saturday at 2:30, online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.